tonight on Straight Talk, Portland's economy is at a crossroads.
It's about keeping the businesses we have and then helping them to grow and stay here.
With a changing downtown, tight housing, and jobs down, all signs showing the city could be stuck in a doom loop.
And when you look at the data, you can make the case that we are in one or that we are on the precipice of being in one.
What action leaders with the Portland Metro Chamber say is needed to get Portland on track. Plus, Oregon Representative Ed Deal joins a growing pool of candidates running for governor.
I think it's time to turn Oregon right side up, and I think it's time to reclaim our state.
His vision, priorities.
Let's find a solution that prioritizes road maintenance, focuses ODOT on their mission, and does not raise taxes and fees. That's what the Oregon people want.
And what he thinks Oregon needs most right now, ahead on Straight Talk. And thanks for joining us here on Straight Talk. I'm Stephanie Domerat. This week, the Portland Metro Chamber released their annual State of the Economy report, giving us a closer look at the economic health of the Portland Metro. And joining us today, Andrew Hone, president and CEO of the Portland Metro Chamber. He's led the chamber since 2018 after serving as president and CEO of the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce. He's also served on several city and regional economic advisory committees. Also with us, Dr. Mike Wilkerson, partner and director of economic research at Eco Northwest. He holds a PhD in economics and politics, and specializes in real estate and economic analysis. He also teaches in Portland State's Master of Real Estate Development program. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
We always look forward to this report every year, so I want to give you first just the opportunity to give us a grade of how Portland Metro is doing right now and some big takeaways. Let's start with you, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, I think oftentimes you want to look at this moment in time and say, how are you doing? Oftentimes, when I have students, the classes they took prior influence their ability to succeed in the current class we're in. And I feel like in this moment in time, a lot of the struggles we are having are because of what we have done previously. And so the grade today is more reflective of what we did or didn't do 2, 3, 5 years ago than it is reflective of where we're at today. And so I think, you know, it's pretty tough to grade today without a heavy curve understanding what those limitations are based on where we've been.
So what would you give the grade of Portland's economy, though, right now?
It's not good. I don't like giving out below C's, but in this case, I think you'd have to do that.
Okay, strong words. Andrew, what were your big takeaways from this report this year?
If people want to understand just where we are contextually, is that we compare to every other city, right? Let's talk about where Portland stacks up against cities. You can generally understand it as this. Amongst every single city in America, 50 big metro regions, we are either last and all the things you don't want to be last in, like employment or housing creation, or first in things that you don't want to be first in, like office vacancies and recovery and foot traffic, or in some cases, taxes, right? So the big takeaway this year is that we are at the bottom amongst every single region in the nation.
Yeah, and that is not good news.
Not good news whatsoever.
So last year, you came on the show and you talked about an urban doom loop that we were in. Mike, that was a big term. I think it was the term of the year, some people called it. Can you remind us of what that is exactly? And are we coming out of that? Have we had any progress since last year?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge there is it was meant more as a cautionary tale than a diagnosis of where we're at in the moment. And so the cautionary tale is, in the moment, you don't know you're in those types of feedback loops. In hindsight, you can look back and say, okay, if this is 5 or 10 years in, oh, clearly we were in it at that moment in time. And so last year with the report, it was really saying, we now have 2 or 3 years of data trending in the wrong direction. This is a moment of time to assess, okay, why are we here? And unfortunately, this year, we're in the same circumstances Andrew mentioned. We don't see any improvement across indicators. And in many instances, we're worse off than we were.
Wow. Okay. Let's talk about jobs. I want to get into what was actually in the report. So the report shows the region lost 8,800 jobs in 2025, ranking 4th worst among metros in the country. It also shows Portland employment continued to contract, even as the national economy actually expanded, which is different from what we usually see in Portland's history. Mike, what is driving this?
There's a couple of factors. One, population and jobs are related. So when your population is declining, oftentimes people are going to move and they're going to take their job with them. I think we also have overweight sectors that we have relied upon for a lot of our success historically, and the leading firms in those sectors are really struggling, and that has ramifications for the rest of the economy.
What does it say to you, Andrew, when you see this happening and it being different than the national trend?
Well, if you really then take it away from the national, but then dial it in locally, we are one region, so we're three economies on the Oregon side of the river, one north of the river. And the story actually gets worse if you take out north of the river, where you're seeing all the growth concentrated in Clark County. You know, good example, you know, they're up nearly 16% of their overall employment growth. We are down in Multnomah County nearly 7%. So you see this complete disaggregation between two sides of the river. And the reason why is our policy choices. We have chosen the path that we are on here on the Oregon side of the river, and we are seeing the consequences play out. Therefore, it is time to make anything less than, I should say, radical change.
What specific change, as you say, radical change, like what specific policies or things do you see that leaders in Portland or Oregon could do?
Sure, it's really simple. Here in Multnomah County, we have the nation's highest business taxes. The nation's highest business taxes and the second highest personal income taxes, only less than New York City. We can't be that way. As Mike said, with population in decline or flatlining, we need to attract business, help business grow, and attract households too. If you're number one in those two indicators, you are not going to do either of those things.
Let's talk about housing. That was another thing this year. The report says that housing production slowed sharply and affordability, which I think was also like a term of the year really last year and still is, remains out of reach for many households. What's causing the slowdown right now in this, Mike? And you know, why is this important for the broader economy?
Yeah, historically, Oregon has leveraged, let's say, our natural abundance through a second paycheck, which is to say, the incomes here may not be higher, but living here is great. And housing has been affordable, and that's been part of that recipe for success. Over the last decade plus, we have seen an erosion of affordability for renter households and for ownership as well. And ultimately, not building enough housing over the last decade is now seeing the results of that. And so in this moment in time, we can't unwind the clock. We can't go back 10 years and say, if we had built more housing. And so we are really stuck in this moment where people are spending more of their income on rent, and not building is certainly not helping with that in this moment in time.
So building or policies that would help with building quicker, is that something that you're supporting?
Oh, absolutely. And then, you know, on a national scale of real estate investability for 2 years running, the Portland region's been 80 out of 81 major American regions in terms of how investors look at investability in this community. So that obviously is a huge inhibitor to building housing. And so I think it starts with just a general culture of trying to attract business, attract investment, having a real conversation with business. And then, yeah, it's got to be accelerated permitting, reducing regulations that you don't need right now. If housing is an emergency, it's an emergency. And if the city of Portland is sitting on $100 million in unspent housing money, it needs to get on the street immediately, helping people to get housed. And then rapid fire building housing in the central city. We've got three mega projects that are ready to go: Broadway Corridor, OMSI, and Albina Vision Trust. Invest in those three things, build thousands of units of housing. Really straightforward.
We've seen mortgage rates go down a little bit in the last year, just about around 6% now. Do you think that mortgage rates play a role here?
Unfortunately, the mortgage rates alone can't make up the gap in affordability. Prices have grown so much faster than incomes over time. Even if we were to unwind mortgage rates back to 4% or sub 4%, which is very unlikely to happen, really it's an income problem at this point. And that's the challenge in the short run, is the cures for the affordability are really medium term and long term. Interest rates could go down. That will certainly help. Prices generally don't fall by meaningful amounts. So even if prices were to slow down or maybe hold stagnant, really it's a question of, can incomes grow faster? And that's where we're at today.
Andrew, we just have about a minute left. So for viewers and Portlanders and people who love Portland, you know, what can they do? What are the things that can move the needle here?
Well, we have a policy agenda out there. They can obviously get behind that. But I think they should be really watching the conversations around the Moda Center, because keeping the Trailblazers here, it's more than about keeping our home team. This is about investing in what we have and growing its ability to be successful. the contemplation of what we might do around the Moda Center is not just to keep a team here. It's about growing our ability to have more events, more activities there. And I think if there's a core message, that has to land, is that everybody needs to get behind supporting their local business community, keeping what we have, investing and growing it right here at home.
And if people want to see more about the report, of course, they can go on our website and do that. But Andrew, Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate you. All right, coming up next here on Straight Talk, Oregon State Representative Ed Diehl and his run for governor. Stay with us. And welcome back to Straight Talk. The field of Republican candidates for Oregon's governor is continuing to grow. With just over 3 months until the primary, voters are starting to hear more from the people hoping to lead the state. And that includes Ed Diehl, state representative for Oregon's 17th district in the Oregon House of Representatives. He was first elected in 2022, and he serves on several House committees, including as vice chair of the Health Care Committee. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you, Stephanie. Good to be here.
Appreciate your time. Okay, well, first, I just want to start with what prompted your decision to run for the governor of Oregon?
Yes. Well, Oregon has a lot of problems, and I think I'm in a unique position to solve them. I have a bachelor's and master's in mechanical engineering. Before I got into the legislature, I built and ran a business with my wife and two partners. We did factory automation and control systems. So that is my background in engineering and business. And I solve problems for a living. And I get results. And I look at Oregon, and we live in the most, I think, the most beautiful state in the country. We really do. It's one of the reasons I live here. The rivers and streams, the mountains, you got the coast. But what good is that if you can't afford to live here? What good is that if your kids can't get a good education, or you don't feel safe on your streets, or businesses are fleeing? So I want to build an Oregon that is not only the most beautiful state in the country, but the best state to live, work, raise a family, and retire. And that's my vision for what we can do with Oregon. And for me, that starts with a government that is accountable. I believe after four decades of one-party governance, it doesn't matter what party you're in, your government is no longer accountable. Maxine Dexter, Congresswoman Maxine Dexter, said it best, the Democrat Party in Oregon's gotten lazy. So we need a government that's accountable. I want cost of living that is affordable, and I want to see an economy that is thriving, and I know I can do that.
And we'll get into specifics about how you feel you know you can do that, but you were first elected to the Oregon House in 2022, as we mentioned. How do you feel like your time in the state legislature has helped you prepare for this?
Well, I've been in there long enough to see what's broken, but not long enough to have it break me. So I have a really good feel for how things work, and my approach in the legislature is really I work with everybody in there, and I try and find common ground with everybody. You know, being in my position, what I've seen is there's a lot of things that go on in that building that I know the Oregon people don't agree with, but they're going through anyway, and it's very frustrating. Bills that I know would be unpopular kind of get rammed through there, and other bills that I know would be popular are stopped. And this referendum is the classic case in point, where we had a bill that was wildly unpopular with the Oregon people and went through anyway. And so we had an opportunity to push back on that. So I really see myself as someone who's representing, has a good take on where the Oregon people are at. And I want to make sure that they're represented in their government.
So we are seeing, we'll talk more about the referendum, you know, and ODOT and the impacts of that. But the primary right now, the amount of people who want to become the Republican nominee for governor is growing, as we mentioned. What do you think you have that makes you stand out from the others right now?
I think a lot of it is my background. You know, I came from a pretty middle-class family. My dad was a logger and a truck driver. I had a great opportunity to go to a great university, Stanford. Got a bachelor's in mechanical engineering, a master's in mechanical engineering, smart product design. So that gives me, I look at things at a system level, and really, how do I fix problems? And then my business background. You know, I started I took that risk. I sold a car. I put my house on the line with two little kids at home and started a business with my partners and my wife, and built that up to about 100 employees. So we had 100 folks, family wage, living wage jobs that we were supporting. And I know how that works, okay? And I think that is unique in all the field, on the R side and the D side. And so I want to bring that to the governor's office.
Some of the priorities you've emphasized are education, homelessness, forest management, and supporting ranchers and farmers. But if you were governor today, what would be the first thing you'd want to focus on?
The first thing I want to focus on is I want to make sure that our agencies are accountable and have the right priorities. And we're just not doing that right now. And everybody, I think, is well aware with it. We're well aware of it because of the referendum process. So one thing I want to do is do 100% performance audit, detailed performance audit on every agency. I want to know where every ounce of taxpayer dollars is going to. We have doubled our state budget in 10 years. Doubled it. You can't explain that with inflation. You can't explain that with population growth. And people are just not feeling the love from that. They're not getting the value for that. So we need to be really clear that our agencies have the right priorities that are aligned with the Oregon people and are spending that money wisely. That's number one.
When you're talking about education, too, you said that was one of your priorities.
Yeah.
It's on your website as your top priority. Democrats argue that Republicans may be concerned about costs when it comes to education, but maybe don't bring solutions or specific solutions to the table to improve, you know, Oregon outcomes for students. What do you think needs to be done around education that you'd want to focus on?
That's a ridiculous claim. We should be concerned about cost. Everybody should be. We don't have an infinite supply of money. We need to make sure that money's being used wisely. In Oregon, this governor is the superintendent of public education, so you have a key role in that. I don't think anybody in Oregon feels like our public schools are doing a great job. We are spending tons of money and getting dismal results. Part of that is we do not have the right priorities. So for me, as superintendent of public education, I want to get them focused on the core focus of education, reading and writing and arithmetic. I would get DEI out of our schools and focus on building great citizens. And I don't think it's that complicated. If you talk to teachers, regular teachers, they're as frustrated as we are. They don't have the ability to even control their own classrooms. And they want to focus on the same things that I want to focus on. So I believe that we can bring our schools back. It's not a money issue. It is a priorities issue.
Okay, let's talk about the referendum that you mentioned about ODOT and the transportation tax last year that will now be going to the voters instead. Why did you feel that was necessary? You really led the charge against that.
I had some great partners with Jason Williams and Senator Bruce Starr. But I led the volunteer signature gathering effort, all volunteers. And I think I was the only legislator that was willing to jump in there. But what I saw in the building is we had a governor and a Democrat leadership that openly defied the will of the Oregon people. They rammed this bill through. They knew it wasn't popular, but they didn't think that the people would speak up. And so we had the opportunity, despite the governor narrowing that window down of time that we could gather signatures. We needed 79,000 signatures. We gathered 250,000 signatures plus in 38 days. That is unprecedented.
We have heard from ODOT, who has said we could have to make layoffs. We will have to reduce service to roads. You know, what do you think needs to happen? What would you say to them who say that? This will be the response of this.
We don't want to see maintenance folks laid off. We want to see maintenance prioritized above all. If you go look at the priorities for ODOT right now and look at what their strategic plan is and their top three goals, you know what the top goal for ODOT is equity. Equity doesn't fill potholes. It doesn't pave roads. I want road safety and maintenance prioritized above all. I think if we get our priorities straight, and we demonstrate to the Oregon people that we have those straight, and we're using their money wisely, then we can have a conversation about what funding is needed. We also fund our ODOT in a wonky way. It's all based on fees. There's no reason we couldn't use general fund money. There's no reason we couldn't do other things to make sure that ODOT is funded. But it starts with having the right priorities, and you demonstrate to the Oregon people that you're doing that.
Okay, just because we're limited on time, I'm going to move on to something else. It's a national issue that's been top of mind for many Oregonians, is immigration enforcement. Yeah. How do you feel the actions of ICE have gone so far in our state?
I have mixed feelings about that. I would say as governor, number one, I want to make sure that we are cooperating with federal law enforcement to get the bad guys out of here. As governor, I will not be protecting human traffickers, gang members, prostitution ringleaders. And right now, our governor has drawn this hard line where our law enforcement cannot cooperate, even cooperate with the feds. That's unconscionable to me. We need that cooperation. And that's simple, to get the bad guys out of here. And I also believe we need to have communication with the feds so there's some transparency in what's going on. And frankly, if I was governor, the heat would go down on this. And I don't believe that ICE would even feel the need to be here because we would be cooperating to begin with to go after the bad guys.
You said you had mixed feelings. So what else is there that you felt like was a mixed
feeling? So I have seen some actions recently, some Venezuelans were detained. They were brought back. I would like some transparency over that and understand what that Venezuelan family, why that happened. I don't think it's clear. I think they came in to the country under one set of rules, and then those rules changed. But I would like some transparency and understand what the feds are doing in that case. And as governor, I would be working with them, I would be communicating with them to understand. I would not be screaming at the sky. I would not be pushing and not allowing law enforcement to even cooperate and get the bad guys out of this state. So it'd be much different.
One more thing, just because we only have 30 seconds, but you said as governor, you would want to cooperate with law enforcement, which is right now the sanctuary laws that we have in place. Do you mean you would want to change those laws?
I think that where things got off the rails was in with Kate Brown's executive order back in, I think, 2017, and then that was put in law in 2021. And that drew a hard line where law enforcement can't even cooperate with the federal government. We need to be able to cooperate in order to make sure we do our obligation as state law enforcement to provide safe communities.
Okay. Republican candidate for governor and State Representative Adil, thank you so much for being with us today. And we mentioned the growing list of Republican candidates for governor. There are currently 13 on the Republican ticket. That includes Senator Christine Drazen, who narrowly lost the 2022 governor's race and is seeking a rematch against Tina Kotek, centering her campaign around affordability and what she calls failed leadership at the top of state government.
We have got to figure out how we are going to hold the line on taxes, how we can roll back taxes, and how we can listen to Oregonians again. So number one, I am running for governor because I believe that our state can be the best place in the nation to raise a family and start your business and learn a trade and get a world-class education. But we have to fix affordability.
Chris Dudley is running for a second time. The former Portland Trailblazer first ran in 2010, losing by a slim margin. He says Oregon lacks accountability and leadership and wants to focus on the economy, education, and livability, working across party lines to solve problems.
All the partisan, the name-calling, finger-pointing, we got to stop that. We need someone from outside who has the expertise to come in and say, hey, we can work together and we can solve this state's problems.
And we will have Dudley on next week on Straight Talk. And in her run, Marion County Commissioner Danielle Bethel is focusing on local issues, small business support, and improving government accountability. And finally, David Medina, a conservative with a large online following. Medina is known for being pardoned by President Trump after charges related to January 6th. He wants to increase public safety and clean up Portland streets. The primary election is on May 19th. The winner is presumed to face Governor Tina Kotek in November. We will be keeping tabs on these races as the primary election inches closer. You can find more information on all the candidates and updates at kgw.com. Thanks so much for joining us this week on Straight Talk. A reminder, you can stream Straight Talk on your own schedule anytime. You can download the free TV app, KGW Plus. It's available now on Roku, Apple TV, and Fire TV. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next week.